This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That I did and really came to fruition last year when I realized that this was a full production. It was a full production of recognizing the space. And as I was exploring Insatiable, one of the things that came out of this was the idea that Insatiable wasn't something that I wanted to try to get rid of, but it could be a moment of acceptance that being hungry all the time or having this thing that motivates you could actually be quite beautiful as well.
You always come up with provocative titles. Like for your individual performance piece, it was Choking. This is Insatiable. And I think that it really gets people to think about a particular performance before you even start. Because you don't normally associate Portland, well, any taiko, really, with something provocative, you know, something that could be weird. You know, it's always very traditional, and you might have, you know, the flower of the spring of the this, you know,
so or the waves of the thunder and the storm, and those are definitely a lot of taiko and natural elements are definitely some of the more typical maybe associations of the sound of the drums. And that definitely is something that resonates within my artistic voice, is that these provocative words start to become conversations and stories and narratives, and they go farther than, for me, than just trying to reenact a natural occurrence, but to actually go into real life, personal story, ownership. I definitely do a lot of that kind of work, especially in this production of asking the performers to think about what Insatiable was in their personal life, tell me stories, give me poses and pictures and images, and they actually all gave me music that represented Insatiable. So all of this infuses this production.
And you've got how many performers in this piece?
It's a small ensemble of five performers, three of them actually Portland taiko, and two of them are guest artists, actually from other taiko groups.
Oh, which other ones?
So one is Lika Roberts. Lika Siegel. She changed, that's her maiden name. That's how I knew her before. And she's from Seattle Kokon Taiko. I've actually been working with her because of her interest, particularly in some of my former works and how it's emotionally sort of fed her and nourished her artistic taiko work. The other person is Yuta Kato. Yuta actually was in Portland Taiko about 7 years ago. He then went on an odyssey. He went to Japan. He studied there. Many wonderful classical Japanese taiko teachers in Japan. Also went to Hachijo Island, studied with them, played with them more so. And he's about to go to Los Angeles to start a Los Angeles Taiko Institute. And right now he's in a transition, so he decided to join this production.
And you have Toru Watanabe, who I adore. I think he's just wonderful. And then who is the other person?
So in addition to Toru Watanabe is Karen Tingy, and she's a longtime Portland Taiko member. Also, when she first started playing Taiko, she used to be a dancer. She used to be a modern dancer. And so this production is really bringing out that skill in her.
So you've got this tight, and you're in it, I assume, too.
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Yeah, so don't leave yourself out. So you got this small ensemble. What is it about doing a piece that's small with a provocative title like Insatiable that allows you a different kind of creativity?
Yeah, for a small ensemble, lots of things that we can do in the rehearsal is, of course, have more individual story and more individual sort of input into the production itself. When you have a large ensemble, of course, with rehearsal times being so limited, you always have to make those choices. And it's oftentimes instead of, for instance, just a one-word statement, here we've been doing journal writings. I've been asking them individually to give me, as I mentioned before, pictures for one of the solos that I want each of them to create. It's about machines in our life and how it's now surrounding us and almost becoming a personal friend. And
like our iPhones and our smartphones and how we just can't live without them kind of thing.
Exactly. And so the moment of examining that, like, wow, this is actually something that I've personalized, but it's really this little machine that is just powering through, functioning and just never ending, working for me. And what is our relationship to that? So we created pictures, and from those pictures, I sort of created a collage. And that's only the kind of work that I can do, particularly in small ensemble, where I can take that time and take each individual's voice and put that all together to create actually one composition.
To make it more personal, too.
Absolutely.
So that's one theme regarding machines. What are some of the other themes?
Some of the other themes, there's this idea of repetition, cycles. That idea of insatiable, for me, is, of course, the idea of being hungry. But I think of that always coming back and back and back and back and more and more and more. And so this production, I've actually had to ask myself, how much repetition could exist in this production? Lots of times my compositions, I find myself going, oh, I better move on. I better go to the next thing right away, because I don't want anyone to feel like I stayed somewhere too long. And oftentimes, as I reflect back on some of my past compositions, I realize, actually, I could have maybe done something a little bit longer, or I could have repeated this just to make more emphasis. And this production is asking me to do that, asking me to take that time.
So it's more of a symphony, isn't it, with a various movements?
Absolutely. I see it as a whole bunch of different suites, but as I put the full production together, one of the things that I loved about this is that I through composed the production, meaning I started with one piece and I went to the next. But when I went, for instance, to the third or fourth piece, I realized that there were some rhythms or some sections that felt right to bring back into what you might consider the next suite. And so oftentimes we aren't able to do that. We're just thinking individually, 5 to 8 minutes, next, next, next. And so there's a lot of reference that happens throughout this production.
Now, this is a longer piece than normally you would associate with Portland Tycho, being that here's one, you know, maybe 10-minute piece, or here's another that's 15. This is one epic, lengthy piece.
Yes, it's from the start all the way to the end. And we often talk about seamless, but I really feel that this is seamless. I have definitely been inspired by some of my newest sort of passion, which is contemporary dance, where I watch a show and I'm so immersed in it. And then, of course, we don't recognize or acknowledge the ending until the very, very end. And in some ways, for me, even though it sounds in some ways insignificant because there's so many other kinds of shows like this, but for me, this is very different for the Tycho world.
North American Tycho or just any Tycho?
Any Tycho. The typical format would be to do a series of 5 to 8 minute pieces, and after each piece, there would be the sort of acknowledgement, the applause after each piece. And so, rarely do you have, I don't think I've ever seen any Tycho concert where it just goes from the beginning all the way to the end.
You know, I've loved Portland Tycho since the 90s, and I've seen it grow in many different ways. Since you have come on board as artistic director, the aspect Portland Tycho's always done original composition, mm-hmm. and it's one of the few Tycho groups that has. Yeah. But for some reason, with you as a dancer, you as an individual artist, you as somebody who I think likes to experiment more, it has grown in a different direction, and I have to say, it's a great direction, and I owe that to your artistic direction. Do you ever find any kind of, I guess, opposition? Because there's always the issue of preservation versus pushing forward.
That is a complex point. I first thank you and appreciate all the words that you just said. It empowers me. But I know that there's a perception of Tycho. And for that, I really create a balance when I think about Portland Tycho. We have typically 2 to 3 home season shows a year. And one of the shows, I believe, is always a celebration of kumideiko or ensemble drumming, that power, ensemble, full group. Again, going back to those 5 to 8 minute pieces where you can enjoy a diversity of ideas, that's definitely something that we include as one of our home season shows. And the other show is, as you mentioned, very experimental. And every year, there's always something different that I'm exploring. And I feel really lucky that I have a company that's not afraid to do that. But also, in some ways, the audience who kind of understands that balance. Okay, I'll take a risk on this one, and I'll know that I'll feel a little bit more settled maybe in the expression of the other. So I like that, in some ways, full balance of thinking of these two opposites as nourishing and hoping that everyone is really enjoying that adventure.
Well, my background is in theater, so I liken it to a full season of shows where you have the classic, you know, and you have a whole repertory, right? You have the classic, you have the original works, and you have, you know, maybe the comedy here and the drama there. And so it seems to me that that's what you've brought into it, is more of a repertory feel.
Exactly. I really think of an entire year and an entire season as a sort of evolution, and I want to give a very full experience.
So in Insatiable, what is your personal feeling towards that word?
My personal feeling, I'll say my first personal feeling was that it was overwhelming. It was something that I felt was something I could never accomplish, and it made me feel defeated in some ways. And when I started tackling it, it was like, okay, well, you're here in my life, and so I don't want to let you sort of beat me down. I want to think about this word. And now that I have brought it into sort of this artistic expression through taiko, I sort of now see it as a very beautiful thing in my life, and that the more I can acknowledge it, the more I can sometimes accept it, and accept that there's going to be some things that are constantly asking me for just a little bit more. And sometimes then I'll have to ask myself, can I do more? Do I want to do more? And most usually the answer is yes, I want to.
So you did a very brave thing in that you had an invited preview to get feedback on a new work. This new work that mixes dance and, you know, drumming, as well as, I guess, emotional content. What was the response, and did it affect how you're going to do the final performance?
Yeah, well, one of the things that it did was I actually took a risk and did a piece that was unfinished, and I was not sort of satisfied with it. And we did it, and what was good is that there were some elements in there that actually I came out of it hearing some thoughts and realizing new directions. But I also realized that there were some things that I was just doubting, those personal moments where you're second guessing yourself. And I think that's where I'm at right now with some of the production. I'm second guessing my intuition. And what the preview did was to recognize that some of my intuitive thoughts, the core of my thoughts, actually have value to it. And I will say that many of the feedback that I received was much more nourishing and just like, go for it, which feels, I don't know, I think I feel really appreciative and honored that that's the kind of feedback that I received at such a raw period of time.
But you did you have any feedback where you thought, well, I'll change this because it isn't quite clear or quite communicating?
Well, there is one thing that is more of a logistic that happened. So at our studio, we actually have a carpet, and that's not usually what you perform on. So I have this one piece where we're using cloth, really large pieces of cloth in this piece, which will be used throughout the show in sort of evocative ways. And at one point, there are pairs of people who are holding the cloth and holding it taut across the room, and I'm dancing along it like an alleyway. But the thing is, when I danced on it on an actual dance floor, then I would step and I would slip, and I realized that, oh, I can't be turning, or I cannot be doing certain kinds of footwork. So I did make an adjustment from the rehearsal at the rehearsal, pre-rehearsal before the rehearsal preview. But I have to go back to the drawing board because the actual floor surface is something that I have to reconsider.
So those are all important things, right? Those are well worth risking an audience to try it out on. In the time remaining, what are some of the other performances people can look forward to in the next few months?
In the next few months, well, one isn't really a performance, but it's our annual benefit banquet. We do perform there, but that's going to be May 9th, and it's a really wonderful food festivity.
Are you doing something for the Cherry Blossom Festival, too?
Yes, we're going to be at JAZO, Japanese American Society of Organs, Sakura Sunday, and that will be, of course, in the Tom McCall Park, is that right?
Yeah, Waterfront Park.
Thank you. Where the beautiful cherry blossoms are. So we'll be there April 7th. We'll, of course, be starting some of the spring festival seasons and summer festivals as well.
And probably lots of touring, too.
Yes, actually, we're on our way to Michigan following Insatiable. So we're going to be performing at the Kirtland Theater.
All those travels. That's so great. Well, thank you, Michelle Fuji, for taking the time to tell us about your new work, Insatiable, and kudos to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you.
And what do you say? Do you say anything for break a leg for Taiko?
I think it's more like ganbatte, which is, you know, go for it, or yeah, persevere.
Ganbatte.
Thank you.
We just heard from Portland Taiko's Michelle Fuji talking about Insatiable, their new concert. Showtimes for Insatiable are Friday, March 29th at 8 p.m. and Saturdays, March 30th, 2 and 8 p.m. All shows are at Lincoln Hall at Portland State University. That address is 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. For tickets, visit portlandtaiko.org, and you can also visit the PSU box office to buy tickets. You can also contact Portland Taiko for more info at 503-288-2456. That's 288-2456. And we have a pair of tickets to offer, but we're going to do it a new way here on Stage Studio. I want to see how plugged in you are with social media. So if you're listening right now, just log on to Stage and Studio on Facebook. You can make a comment about why you listen to Stage and Studio, and the outstanding comment will win a pair of tickets, and I might even read it on the air next week. Just visit facebook.com/stage_studio. That's facebook.com/stage_studio. Make a comment about why you listen to the show, and you could pick up a pair of tickets to Portland Taiko's Insatiable. Amy Roberts, Stage and Studio. Next up, Whitebird Dance recently presented the Portland debut of New Zealand's acclaimed dance company, Black Grace. Many Americans may be familiar with the All Blacks rugby team in New Zealand as they perform their haka, traditional Maori warrior dance they use as a warm-up. New Zealand's leading contemporary dance company, Black Grace, also uses the Maori haka movement. They also use Samoan traditions while being cutting-edge artistically. I talked with Black Grace before they kicked off their North American tour. 11 mostly Samoan and Maori dancers fill the stage in Portland. Black Grace is performing a piece based on the traditional ideas of Samoan slap dancing. Dancers make sky-high jumps and quick turns to create complex rhythms of floor stomping, cries, and body slaps. Artistic director Neil Iramea says he took Samoan slap dancing and melded it with a children's hand game to make a statement about child abuse.
It's a big thing back home, particularly in our indigenous culture. And being of Pacific Island descent, you know, I'd have kids, mates come to school all the time, bruises and what have you, and sometimes they wouldn't turn up at all. And then they'll turn up sort of 6 weeks later after the cast had come off a broken piece of their body or something. So it was tough to reflect that back on our communities, but I really felt that's part of my responsibility.
That responsibility to tell authentic stories through dance was something Iramea felt passionate about 18 years ago when he formed Black Grace. But the decision to become a professional dancer wasn't met with enthusiasm by his Samoan family.
In New Zealand, the Pacific Island community is a minority, and it's not huge by any stretch of the imagination, and it's had its fair share of knocks. We're normally thought of as unskilled labour, and when you finish high school, if you finish high school, you're either going to go on welfare or you're going to go and get a job in the local factory. I told my parents that I wanted to go to dance school. I'd been working in a bank for 2 years and was doing rather well, but I told them, and my mother cried, and my father simply just did his traditional Samoan and shook his head and walked away from me.
In the end, his parents supported his plan to start a Samoan and Maori contemporary dance company, and during lean times, they even put up their house as collateral for a loan. Iramea says that kind of courage is at the heart of the name Black Grace.
If you took on the school bully and you knew that you had no chance in hell of surviving a beating from him, but you did it anyway for your mates, then we would say that you were black. Equally, if you asked the prettiest girl in the high school to go out with you, and again, you had no chance. Just the fact that you were daring and willing to do that, we would say you were black. So the word black became synonymous with sort of courage and this idea of taking a few risks.
For Iramea, the risk paid off. He says Black Grace is now the largest contemporary dance company in New Zealand. Dancer Sean McDonald was a classmate of Iramea's and jumped at the chance to perform dance that spoke to his Maori heritage.
I didn't grow up sort of specifically cultural in the sense my parents grew up at a time when I wasn't encouraged to be of your culture, to be sort of Maori and to speak the language, and I grew up in the city. So I was excited.
And Black Grace is exciting to watch. Walter Jaffe, co-founder of Whitebird Dance, which brought the company to Portland, says it's incredibly athletic.
They look like rugby players, soccer players. And the thing that is so amazing is just to watch these strong men do this incredible movement, whether it's athletic or lyrical. They basically can do anything.
Neil Iramea says in traditional Pacific Island culture, there's no separation between singing and dancing, so Black Grace often fuses singing with the dance. One example is how Iramea adapted Minoi Minoi, a children's song about worker ants.
The traditional song goes, Minoi Minoi Minoi, Minoi Peo Seloi, Ah Siva Siva. It's very upbeat, it's very happy, and it's, you know, it's getting little kids to be a certain way. Minoi basically means move.
Minoi Minoi, Minoi Peo Seloi.
But Iramea changed it to a minor key to be a more emotional song and then fused it into a haka-style modern dance. When it comes to music, Iramea says his father often acts as a cultural advisor, directing singers on recording sessions. His dad's voice is even featured in many of their soundtracks. It's a way to keep his family with him wherever he goes.
It's lovely to hear those songs and to hear your family's voices behind you, especially when you're on the stage in another country. That's fantastic. It sort of grounds you and reminds you of what's really important.
Minoi, minoi, minoi peo seloi. Minoi,
noi pe o se loi. A siva siva ua ma o i oi. Lo 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 fa a pe e pe e ua lo i loi. Suiti su ma le pe o se poi. Mi noi na loi. Mi noi pe o se loi. A siva siva ua ma. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
To see and read more about Black Grace and their North American tour, you can visit their site at blackgrace.com.nz. That's blackgrace.com.nz. We'll also have that link at stageandstudio.org. You can check out the whole Whitebird dance season at whitebird.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org, where you can hear a podcast of the show. You can also download shows at iTunes, and don't forget to like us on our facebook.com/stage, the letter N studio page. And you can pose a comment on why you listen to this show on the Facebook page. And again, that's facebook.com/stage, the letter N studio. Post a comment, and you can win a pair of tickets to the next concert at Portland Tyco. You can also tweet me with a comment at Stage, the letter N studio. Till next time, I'm Dimae Roberts.
Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, died last week, and hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets to mourn him. Arguably the most influential leader in Latin America for over a decade, what will his legacy be? Join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlund, for a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies at Pomona College and author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. That's this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting Alligator Records rhythm and blues artist Tommy Castro and the Painkillers, 8 p.m. Thursday, March 14th. Tickets and information for Tommy Castro and the Painkillers at the Aladdin box office and aladdin-theater.com.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest is abstract painter Deborah Gillis. Deborah has a show of recent paintings at Butter's Gallery, which continues until March 30th. Welcome, Deborah. It's lovely to have you here at KABU.
Oh, it's good to be here, Joseph.
Your paintings have become progressively more abstract over the last decade, less and less like landscapes, which they used to be. Why is that?
Well, my work has always been about the natural world. For a number of years, though, my work was concerned with investigating human perceptions of nature. And I did these large-scale landscape paintings of Western vistas. They were ambiguous as to the location or time of day, but they were very atmospheric. And they kind of stood in for the American psyche, as I said, the romantic vision of our place in the greater world. I was interested in capturing the emotion that a place evokes. And so this was the work that I did for a number of years. And then 2001 came. And actually, I was having a show at that time. And mm-hmm. it was like everything just dropped off the face of the earth. Mm-hmm. And it was, and at that point, my work took a change, and it was this paradigm shift, I think, in just the world as we see it. And my work took that change towards abstraction.
So that change started back then?
Yes.
And it's continued
yes.
slowly?
Yes.
Okay.
So moving in that
so
direction.
10 years later,
yes.
abstraction is kind of the fruition of
it
that
wasn't,
change?
Initially, it wasn't intentional. It was just my response to that world change.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have a painting called Fata Morgana, which is named after a type of mirage. Tell us about that mirage, what kind of mirage it is, and just tell us about the painting and the title.
Okay, Fata Morgana mirage. It's an unusual and complex form of a superior mirage, and when it's kind of like the super mirage, where you might have three images on top of each other. One would be upright, inverted, and then upright again. And also, this refers to the Arthurian sorceress, Morgan Le Fay, and it's the belief that the mirages were like fairy castles, and that they were false land and created by witchcraft. And this was one thing that, you know, where the name Fata Morgana comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think, you know, these mirages, they have stories of, you know, these where people were looking for the Northwest Passage and they saw these huge mountain ranges and turned back. I mean, and, you know, it's amazing how real these mm-hmm. things can be.
They turned back because they thought they couldn't get through.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So how does a name get attached to one of your paintings?
Well, in this case, I had a group of work that I was working on that had to do